And good morning. We're just waiting for Judge Siegel to rejoin us here and we'll get started.
My apologies. I forgot my screen was off. I'm sorry.
No problem. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second case that is scheduled for oral argument this morning. It is the matter of Aaron Harkins versus Grant Park Association, case number A20-0937. I just have a few preliminary remarks to make before we launch into our arguments. We are appearing on the Zoom platform this morning due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the argument that you're about to make is recorded and will be available shortly on the court's website. Otherwise, no other recordings are permitted. The regular rules of decorum do apply during this argument. And if we lose anybody due to connection issues this morning, we will pause the argument and wait until everyone has rejoined before we continue. There's a timer in the corner of your screens. Can both counsels see that? You can just nod your heads. All right, I'm seeing nods. And that timer will be used to count down your arguments this morning. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present an argument. Respondent will then have 15 minutes. And appellant will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal argument. Finally, I will just ask counsel to please introduce themselves before they begin their presentations this morning. And one other tip, if you're not actively making an argument or you're a spectator here, just please make sure that you keep your mute button on and don't forget to turn it off when you begin your argument. And with that, we will proceed with the attorney for appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Peter Rademacher, counsel for the appellant, Aaron J. Harkins.
And I'm sorry, I'm Melissa Rightoff, and I am counsel for Respondent Grant Park Association.
This case presents the concise question of whether all means all or something less than all. As a unit owner in the Respondent Grant Park Association, Harkins, like his fellow unit owners, is assessed fees for the association's common expenses. As safeguards that would benefit him and his fellow unit owners, Harkins drafted amendments for the association's bylaws that would require it and its management company to consider competitive bids for material transactions with vendors and to disclose any financial interest that the management company has with the selected vendors. Harkins then asked the association to provide him the names and contact information, including email addresses of his fellow unit owners. Harkins asked for this information to obtain the requisite support and proxy designations from his fellow unit owners to get the amendments adopted. Although recognizing that it was obligated to provide at least the names and mailing addresses to Harkins, the association chose to withhold that information until nearly 2 years later, well after Harkins had commenced this lawsuit. And today, nearly 3 years later, the association still refuses to provide Harkins with his fellow unit owners' email addresses, email addresses that the association itself regularly uses to conduct its business. The district court blessed this outcome by concluding that the Common Interest Ownership Acts and the bylaws parallel requirements that the association disclose, quote, all, end quote, of its records to its unit owners really only require it to disclose adequate records. Harkins respectfully asked this court to reverse that portion of the judgment that rests on this erroneous interpretation of the Common Interest Ownership Act and the bylaws, and to vacate the judgment pertaining to Harkins' claims for attorney fees, costs, and punitive damages.
Oh, Mr. Rademacher, if I could ask you a quick question. Your brief, and they were both very good briefs, focuses in on the word all, but it's not just the word all that's either in the statute or in the bylaws, it's all records. So how do you define a record? So it's different from the Data Practices Act, which includes anything and everything. I mean, this statute uses the word, and the bylaws use the word record. And so what does, help me understand what that word means.
Your Honor, I don't think that the definition of the word record has really been an issue raised in this case. It's not been fleshed out. And it does appear from the judgment that the district court accepted that emails in this case would be considered records. It's just a matter of whether or not they are all records or adequate records that would dictate whether they have to be disclosed.
But with statutory interpretation, I mean, it's a de novo standard of review. So help me understand that. Then what is a record?
Well, I'm not prepared to provide a strict definition of that. What I would say is that the record in this case includes emails that were distributed from the association to its members. And so there would be records in that regard. There would be records that would include the unit owners providing their actual email addresses to the association as well. And so I think records would include any type of documentation or whether that be in physical written formats or digital format that the association retains in the conduct of its business.
So would that include emails exchanged between owners or occupants and the association?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would.
So communications specific to, I don't know, problems in individual units?
Yes, any documentation related to the association's conduct of its business as an association.
So your argument is that any owner can get any and all communications of any type?
Well, not
just by asking? I mean, how broad is this then? I get that. I'm just trying to understand, you know, as we're looking at this language and figuring out what it means.
Yes, Your Honor, we're not exactly arguing that a unit owner could access any information that it wanted to. And in fact, that was a concern that the district court raised. And really there's a couple responses to that. First of all, there are other statutes that may come into play when it comes to disclosure of information. We've actually directed the court to section 325E59 specifically, which addresses the use of social security numbers. There may be others as well. And there is one other aspect to this, and that is that section 3118 of the Common Interest Ownership Act and the bylaws, neither one of them require members or unit owners to provide, say, social security numbers, medical records, financial records, things of that nature. And also, neither of them require the association to retain absolutely everything that it takes in or sends out. It only requires them to retain adequate records. That's a separate issue altogether. With the remainder of my time, I'd like to focus in on two points, and we've kind of started to touch on one of them, and that is that the Common Interest Ownership Act and the bylaws plainly require the association to disclose all of its records to Harkins. And the second is that the association's alternative basis for affirmance under the Nonprofit Corporation Act is meritless. Turning to my first point, Section 3118 of the Common Interest Ownership Act requires associations to keep adequate records of, among other things, its membership. Similarly, the bylaws require the association to keep records of, among other things, the names and addresses of its members. These provisions set a baseline for what the association must keep, but they don't prohibit the association from keeping more. And that's where Section 3118 and the bylaws disclosure provisions come in. They require that the association disclose all of its records, which with specific exceptions that are not at issue here. Now, the dictionary definitions, case law, and common usage all reveal unequivocally that all means all. But the district court and the association have collectively provided four primary reasons why it should mean something less than all. First, as it explained in the judgment, the district court reasoned that interpreting all to mean all in the disclosure provision of Section 3118 would render the word adequate in its retention provision meaningless. But these provisions address two separate issues. And we've provided this court with hypotheticals that demonstrate how they can retain their plain meaning and still operate in harmony. Furthermore, we've directed this court's attention to Glen Wright versus St. James Place Condominium Association and Dunbar versus Twin Towers Condominium Association, in which reviewing courts observed the different standards for retention and disclosure in similar, very similar statutes to Section 3118. The district court also reasoned that to interpret all to mean all in the disclosure provision would lead to, quote, an impermissibly broad scope of members' access to the personal information of other members, end quote. And it specifically referenced social security numbers and medical records. Now, we've already touched on a couple reasons why it wouldn't lead to that result necessarily. But I think that there's also one other component to it, and that is that this court in City of Cloquet versus Crandall specifically said that it is not the court's role to decide what, as a matter of policy, is impermissible. That is a legislative function. So while the court may have taken issue with the outcome of interpreting all to mean all, it had no authority to judicially modify its meaning as it did. The association now provides additional interpretive explanations in support of the judgment. First, the association argues that the disclosure provisions in Section 3118, quote, refers directly, end quote, to the records mentioned in its retention provision. It doesn't. We've provided numerous examples of sections that demonstrate the legislature's ability to make direct internal references. If the legislature had intended for Section 3118's disclosure provision to directly reference the records mentioned in its retention provision, it knew how to and it could have done so. Instead, it made a clear statement that all records are subject to disclosure. Finally, the association argues that a justum generis requires this court
to— Can I just interrupt here for a minute? So I'm trying to figure out this language in the statute. I mean, doesn't what you were just talking about, the exception for information that was the basis for closing a board meeting, isn't that kind of an argument against your position in the sense that it really was reflected on, the operations of the association, the conduct of the meetings, the contracts, the leases? That's what's referenced in 3118. So, and we have to read the whole paragraph in context, right? Because the sentence you're looking at, the all records, it doesn't even reference the association in it. It talks about unit owners, but it doesn't even, so you have to read it all together to make sense of it. I guess there was not a question in there, but...
That's okay. I can still respond.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I can still respond. The Section 3118 does reference an exception for records subject to a closed meeting, but it specifically identifies what type of closed meetings, what type of records those refer to. And so if you actually look at Section 515B103G, it identifies that it's referencing personnel records, potential litigation records, criminal activity records, things of that nature. Here, we don't have those types of records involved. So I actually do believe that having the express exception in there works in favor of Harkin's position, because there is a specific set of exceptions and email addresses of unit owners is not among them. And so by just virtue of extension, it should be assumed that the legislature chose not to include it as an exception. Finally, the association argues that a justum generis requires this court to interpret all in the disclosure provision to mean records mentioned in the retention provision. This is simply not the correct context for this canon of construction. A justum generis is used when a list of specific items is concluded with a catch-all term. Here, there is no list concluded with a catch-all term. There are two separate provisions dealing with two separate issues, retention and disclosure. And the disclosure provision uses one word to describe what records the association must disclose: all. Turning to my second point, the association asked this court to rely vaguely on sections 317A165.
I know you've just moved on, but before you do, I just want to make sure that I am clearly understanding your argument. So your argument is that the all is entirely separate from the adequate. Is that what you're arguing?
That is correct, Your Honor. Adequate references what records must be retained. That is the baseline for what must be kept by the association.
And all means all those adequate records plus everything else that an association might have. Okay. Yes.
The association asks this court to rely on sections from the Nonprofit Corporation Act for the extremely broad conclusion that any claim for equitable relief under the Common Interest Ownership Act must be brought by the lesser of 50 members or 10% of the members. Harkins has argued that this alternative defense of the judgment is not properly before this court, and he rests on the briefs for that point. But even if this court entertains it, it suffers numerous faults. First, Harkins' claims are brought under Section 4116 of the Common Interest Ownership Act, not the Nonprofit Corporation Act sections. Section 4116 specifically lays out a cause of action for any person aggrieved by a violation of the Common Interest Ownership Act or an association's governing documents. Contrarywise, the Nonprofit Corporation Act sections do not have anything to do with a violation of the Common Interest Ownership Act. It does not have anything to do with the types of claims that Harkins has brought here.
Can I ask you one more quick question?
Yes, Your Honor.
So your client's position that the language in the statute and the language in the bylaws are not ambiguous, that we can just apply the plain language. All
yes,
means
sir.
All. Okay.
I think I'll close by just mentioning again that Harkins requested nothing more than the names and contact information of his fellow unit owners in order to implement safeguards for financial transactions executed by the association. He asked for this information for the same reason the association has it, to communicate with his fellow members. The district court denied him this right to this information based on an erroneous conclusion that all means something less than all, and we ask the court to reverse that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Rademacher. You will have the opportunity to present a 5-minute rebuttal. And now I will turn to Ms. Rideoff. You may present your argument on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This case concerns the statutory interpretation of the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, or we call it the MCIOA, which is how I'll refer to it. Our position is that the statute requires disclosure of the documents that are only specifically identified within Section 515.3-118. Longstanding Minnesota law concerning statutory interpretation states that courts construe statutory language in the context of the statute rather than interpreting each word as if it were in isolation from the statute and its provisions. Under the Minnesota statute's canons of interpretation, Section 645.083, which governs statutory interpretation of Minnesota statutes, I will quote, "General words are construed to be restricted in their meaning by preceding particular words." Now, this statutory canon is the basis for respondents' argument. The canon is based on this principle that we've been talking about, which is a justum generis, which requires that preceding words assist in construing general words, and that all words in a statute must be given full effect. Now, this canon of interpretation applies here. The MCIOA requires—
Can I interrupt you just for a minute?
Sure.
So one of the allegations in the complaint is that the association conducted business via email. And this is a Rule 12 motion, so we're not allowed to, you know, look at all sorts of other things. And there's not much of a record here. So if the association was conducting the business of the association by email, why isn't the email part of adequate records of its membership then?
Because quite frankly, email is not necessary to conduct the regular business of the association. Now, directors in a homeowners association, they owe a duty to unit owners to act in the best interests of the association and its members. And the association sees itself as a protector of all members and is very concerned about the possible overuse or abuse of its members' personal information, especially emails. So the way associations typically conduct their business is through mail. Email is certainly convenient in this case, but it's not the official way that a homeowners association conducts its business. Going back to the MCIOA, it requires an association to keep adequate business records and lists them, specifically including adequate records of membership, unit owners,
so
meetings.
We've read the statute. So I'm going to ask you the same question. What does record mean? You use the term kind of automatically, I think, of business records. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean in the statute, and what does it mean in the bylaws?
It means the actual records listed in the statute and in the bylaws. So essentially the word records is identified, and those records, as you know, you were just saying that, yeah, these records, you've read them, they're listed, financial records. And here, what we're specifically talking about is adequate records of membership. What are those? The good question is, you know, the MCIOA doesn't actually define the word adequate. So what we're doing is we're looking to the bylaws, which identify what the adequate records are of membership and what the bylaws say in section 2.2 and section 8.5 is that names and addresses are adequate. That is the actual record that the association uses to conduct its business.
Well, why did it take 2 years for the association to provide names and addresses?
That's a great question, Your Honor. And you know what? It's all based on communication issues. I want to point out, really, it's really important that the court understand that the association has never absolutely refused to produce these records. It's actually an issue of fact, and it is beyond the scope of this appeal as to why appellant doesn't currently have the list, but the association disputes that it refused to disclose the list. This disclosure ended up being a discovery dispute because appellant wouldn't agree to keep confidential the names and addresses of his neighbors. At the time that this case was dismissed, I was still attempting to get an agreement from appellant's former counsel on this issue. So it's really a question of fact, but it'll never be a basis, as appellant seems to claim, for some sort of punitive damages claim, which, by the way, there is no punitive damages claim in this complaint because appellant never requested to amend his complaint to add punitive damages. I did want to point that out because that seems to be a big focus of the reply brief and the attorney's fees issue. But really the answer is, It was all a communications issue, and it was a communications issue before this case was filed, and it was a issue I was trying to.
Yeah, and
to
I don't want to get into all of that because I know there's stuff in the district court records about the discovery dispute, but because it doesn't really relate exactly to the issues before us now. So your client does acknowledge, though, that names and addresses, because it requires in the bylaws for unit owners to register, that those would be records that are disclosable or should be made available under the statute and under the bylaws.
Yes,
to a unit owner.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the plain language interpretation of section 515.3-118 is straightforward. According to the statutory canon of interpretation, the association is required to allow review of records that it is required to maintain, which does include the names and addresses of its unit owners. Now, appellant's argument rejects this canon of interpretation and instead relies essentially on the dictionary definition of the word all. But longstanding Minnesota law confirms that the provisions of a statute must be read in context. The word all must be read within the context of the MCIOA and refers directly to the preceding list of records identified in the statute. Here, the list of documents that members are allowed to review includes only those that an association is required to maintain. Member emails are not identified in either the MCIOA or the bylaws. This straightforward, plain language in the interpretation of the MCIOA should prevail, and the district court properly dismissed plaintiff's complaint based on this interpretation of the MCIOA and of the bylaws. Now, with respect to this,
In the bylaws, if I can switch to that just for a minute, it talks about there's the exception for records that may be privileged or confidential information. So there are some things that presumably are records, but that you would not share. So is that, does the association then keep records above and beyond those required by statute? And is that what you're, or how do I understand that?
Sure. We don't believe that the bylaws are a catch-all protection that will protect all private or confidential records. And you're referring to section 8.5 of the bylaws.
Yes, yes, thank you.
And it follows the very same structure as section 515.3-118. It lists the records that an association must keep and then states these records should be available for examination. So the privacy and confidentiality restriction only protects those listed records. There's no clear protection for any other member records that may include evidence maybe of a medical disability or members' personal financial information. And this is all information, these are all possible records that that a association may have, but is not necessarily required to maintain for the purposes of running the business of the association. Some member information may not necessarily even be in the form of a record. So this could be notes of conversations about a medical issue, emails between management and members. We just don't believe the bylaws, if you read the plain language of the bylaws and compare that to the MCIOA, they're not a catch-all protection and don't protect private or confidential information. I'll move on a little bit here to the supporting case law.
Before I just want to touch on a question that Judge Siegel had asked Mr. Rademacher, I think. So are you arguing that the statute is unambiguous and we don't need to get beyond the plain language of the statute to affirm the district court?
Absolutely. I don't think either party argues the statute's ambiguous.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely. Again, the plain language interpretation is just these canons of interpretation, which I love because they're very, very clear and obvious. Section 645.08 lists about, let's see, five of them, and number three is the one that we base our argument on. So, which is why, quite frankly, I don't think that either party supporting case law, while it might be persuasive, it's not really, instructive, because we both cite cases from different, jurisdictions. And while we feel our cases are more persuasive because they actually involve emails, ultimately, I think this really comes down to an issue of statutory interpretation based on Minnesota's own canons of interpretation.
Counsel, excuse me. My understanding is that the bylaws include a requirement that you keep the names and addresses of owners and the address at which they prefer to receive notification of meetings. What if an owner prefers to get notification via email?
You know, Your Honor, I think, again, email is a very convenient way to get notification, but it's not the official way to get notification. I'm unaware at this time of any owners who may or may not have done that. I'm actually unaware of any factual basis by which a association, including our own association, would have asked the owners whether or not they want to receive meetings by email.
My understanding of the record is that when appellant asked the manager said, they admitted they use emails for association business.
The manager, we do use email. The association does use emails for association business as a convenience, but it's not the official way in which an association conducts its business. I think the last basis I want to touch on, or I guess a couple real, I think I did touch on the attorney's fees issue. Again, we believe that the court did in fact use the correct test in which to review the attorney's fees issue. The court decided on attorney's fees with respect to the prevailing party. Respondent is the prevailing party, that's quite clear, and there is no abuse of discretion with respect to that issue. And real quick, I just do believe that the interests of justice rule, rule 103.04, this court can actually choose to review the Nonprofit Act issue, despite that the district court chose to dismiss on other grounds. The interests of justice, of course, is the good of the whole association should be considered. And the purpose of the 50-10 rule is to protect the association from multiple individual member lawsuits. I guess in closing, we will respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision to dismiss appellant's lawsuit and deny him his attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brightoff. And Mr. Rademacher, we will now come back to you if you care to present a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. First of all, the complaint does list punitive damages, and we are pursuing that as part of our suit here. Second, the court has asked what records means. And for that question, I would direct the court's attention to Glenn Wright. In that case, the court grappled with the question of what must be disclosed under a statute that was based on the same model code from which section 3118 comes. There, the court concluded that records may well constitute part of an association's financial and other records if they were, quote, the type of records that the association would create, use, receive, or maintain, and rely upon for the performance of its powers and duties. Here, at the pleading stage, this court must assume that the association has either created, used, received, or maintained, and relied upon the unit owner's email addresses in the performance of its powers and duties. And therefore, we would argue that email addresses are part of the records that the association has maintained. Second, the court has asked opposing counsel why email addresses are not considered adequate records here. The district court resolved this question by concluding that the Common Interest Ownership Act allows associations to define records, to define adequate records in its bylaws. But the Common Interest Ownership Act says nothing of the sort. Section 515B3106A requires associations to have bylaws that, quote, comply with this chapter, end quote. It does not provide authority for associations to define statutory text. And therefore, I do not believe that it is accurate to say necessarily that email addresses don't fall within the scope of adequate records. And I have no further comments unless the court has questions.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Rademacher. And thanks to both counsel for your briefs and arguments this morning. The case was well presented and it is now submitted to us. We will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.